Welcome to the Latchkey Tales, Book 1, Yuki O'Malley and the Belfair, a tale of Victorian horror, written and performed for podcast by MJ Hahn. Chapter 11, The North Wing.
Hello, officer. We've been expecting you. Do come right in.
Devinter's voice rang out from the tiny red call box as the iron gates suddenly swung inward. Yuki looked out from the back seat of the squad car. The cafe across the street was dark. Indeed, the entire neighborhood was quiet. The scene seemed to hang with an eerie calm. There was no trace of Rosie von Bruin or any of the other neighbors, which Yuki thought a little strange. Somehow, she had imagined that by now, there would have been a mob of outraged citizens storming the Curse Castle with torches and pitchforks. But, nope, nothing. It was just her and Officer What's-His-Face. The police car disappeared uneventfully down the dark tunnel, while the black iron gate crashed shut behind them. The officer finally stopped the squad car. The sliding glass doors that led to the Belfair flickered with a dim light from within.
Okay now, Miss O'Malley. Now all we need to do is find your guardian, and we're good.
Guardian?
Yuki's mind raced with questions. The officer stepped out of the car, turned, and opened Yuki's door. After making sure that Mrs. Flack's purse was securely hidden, Yuki hoisted her backpack over her shoulder and stepped out. She noticed several other cars were parked in the underground garage. Devinter, it seemed, had company. With the police officer trailing behind her, Yuki walked through the sliding glass doors and was surprised at what she saw. The chandelier remained where it had fallen, draped over the reception desk like a dead and crumpled spider. In its absence, the Belfair now flickered in candlelight. The piles of crystals, broken teacups, and moldy finger sandwiches had been swept aside. In the distance, at the foot of the marble staircase, several faces suddenly spun around and stared at Yuki. Faces that, oddly enough, she recognized. The scene eerily echoed Yuki's previous vision of the 1885 Coil House opening gala. Her grandmother's followers fanned out before her. Only now the group had seemed to dwindle. Only a fraction of the original members remained. There was Devinter, of course, standing next to the odd pair of widows with their red roses, Mrs. Carstairs and Bilsey, as well as the lawyers, Dermal and Femur, all parchment white and staring intently. The veiled figure of Mrs. Battery loomed from the shadows, and then, glowering from under his mop of black hair, Yuki noticed Mr. Philgrave sitting by himself in a corner. All of the assembly's stares seemed to fix on Yuki. Their pale opalescent eyes flashed with a not-so-subtle predatory gleam that sent a chill down her spine. Apart from the obvious, Yuki thought that something didn't feel right. Something, or rather, someone, seemed to be missing. Then Yuki realized who it was. Madame Lamalle was noticeably absent. Devinter emerged from the group, all smiles as he walked towards the officer.
Oh, thank goodness you found her at last. We've been simply sick with worry.
Yuki looked puzzled as Devinter rushed to her side with outstretched arms. He crushed her in a theatrical hug while the police officer stood blankly at attention.
Well, I guess that will be all, officer. We have things under control now, and I'll take it from here.
The police officer wore a dull expression and merely repeated,
Yes, you'll take it from here.
Devinter raised an eyebrow with a sly smile.
Well, I'm sure Madame Lamalle will certainly be sorry that she missed you. I'm sure she'd have loved the opportunity to get to know you better.
Yes, Lamalle wants to know me better.
Devinter stifled a chuckle with a cough as he bid the officer a pleasant evening. But after the sliding glass doors had closed, Devinter turned back to Yuki, his smile now sharp and brittle.
Well, my dear, had a nice little adventure, have we? You're all right, yes? That mad woman didn't hurt you, did she?
Yuki looked bewildered.
Mrs. Flack? Hurt me?
Well, when we saw that you were gone, we feared the worst.
What do you mean? She just took me sightseeing.
Mrs. Flack has been permanently dismissed from the premises, and she has no right to take you anywhere.
Wait, that can't be right. My mom told Mrs. Flack to look after me until she got back. So if anybody is my guardian, it's Mrs. Flack, not you.
As if anticipating this, Mr. DeVinter unfolded a very long and official-looking document that had been sealed and signed with many signatures.
"Firstly, I regret to inform you that your mother has been indefinitely detained abroad, so who knows when we'll see her again. And I believe that if you have a look at this, you will find that, indeed, I am your legal guardian. And that, my dear, practically makes us family."
"I don't care what it says. I know what my mom said."
Yuki found herself suddenly seething with a dark fury, as if the very walls were fueling her anger, not to mention the peculiar familiarity from having seen DeVinter in the past. It somehow made him seem very small and petty now, certainly anything but intimidating. Possessed with this strange surge of confidence, Yuki decided that she had had just about enough of this little game DeVinter was playing.
"I know all about you, DeVinter. I've seen it. I've seen everything."
Yuki's face flickered in the candlelight. The irises of her eyes suddenly appeared quite black.
"I know what you're up to, and don't think for a minute that I'm going to let you get away with it."
As soon as the words fell out of her mouth, it seemed like they were somebody else's. Yuki's voice carried across the vast room. Sudden murmurs emanated from the little group assembled at the foot of the stairs. The widows were whispering to each other, and the superb acoustics of the room made it seem like they were standing next to her.
"Well, the little one definitely seems to have old you-know-who's fire. Now the baby will certainly be happy."
"No, I know. It's just like I told you, Bibi. It's a miracle."
DeVinter stepped into Yuki's field of vision, his thin smile unbroken, his tone very light. Yuki stood mute, realizing her surge of confidence had melted away.
"Oh, you poor dear. That's just the exhaustion talking. All tuckered out after your busy, busy day. Now why don't you toddle off upstairs? You should get a good night's sleep. You'll be meeting your new governess in the morning."
DeVinter turned on his heel and returned to the assembly. Yuki stood completely dumbfounded. She saw that the group was still staring, especially Philgrave. His eyes burned hungrily from under his brow. Suddenly, Yuki felt like an especially tiny and succulent mouse in a room full of ravenous cats. Without another word, Yuki spun around and made her way towards the mirrored corridor. She turned the corner without looking back and bolted past DeVinter's studio on her way to the supply room and the shortcut back upstairs. When she swung aside the swinging doors, she was shocked at the transformation. Any trace of Mrs. Flack had been completely removed. The homey touches had disappeared and had been replaced by more industrial shelving. A rather austere fluorescent light glared from overhead. One thing was still the same, though. The ancient tea maker was still chugging away, although now, squatting in the harsh shadows, it seemed a little more sinister, rattling and hissing with its yellow dial glowing like the eye of an antiquated cyclops. On one of the new shelves, Yuki saw that the beatable tea maker manual had been left behind. She picked it up and thumbed through the delicate pages full of finely drawn diagrams and columns of notes, which were all signed by the same name. Vernal Golden. Yuki couldn't help cracking a small smile.
"Something Crowley might be interested in seeing. Well, if I ever speak to him again, that is."
Yuki tucked the manual under her arm and made her way back upstairs. Darkness and a pervasive silence greeted Yuki as she stepped through the front door to their flat. She felt along the wall, found the switch, and flicked on the overhead light. With a loud pop, the fixture overhead flashed with a split second of intense light before going dark again. Yuki stood there, temporarily blinded. As her eyes adjusted, the familiar wooziness began to creep over her. Strange shapes seemed to be swimming in the darkness before her. Yuki blinked several times and tried to steady herself against the wall. She fumbled at the light switch panel, and this time a few table lamps managed to stay lit. Light flooded the hallway, and Yuki's vision instantly cleared. The lightheadedness was replaced by a rumble in her stomach. Yuki realized she hadn't really eaten that day, and of course her dinner plans had been cancelled courtesy of Detective Golden and the SFPD. She ventured down the hall towards the kitchen, and flicked on any light that she could along the way. A perfect view of the nighttime city skyline greeted her. The skyscrapers standing in the distance were all dotted with the lights from their office windows. Yuki set her backpack and the tea maker manual on the long granite counter. She was greeted with the sight of a large bowl full of perfectly arranged and polished green apples that Mrs. Flack had presumably left out. Yuki raised an eyebrow and grabbed one. She took a bite as she wondered how Mrs. Flack was doing. She imagined her locked up, frantically dusting and arranging her jail cell.
Poor Mrs. Flack.
Suddenly, Yuki's phone rang from inside her backpack. She unzipped the flap and rummaged around until she found it. Yuki flipped open her phone, then frowned at the caller ID. Crowley Golden. She pushed the ignore button. She wasn't even close to beginning to want to talk to him yet.
I don't care what he's got to say. He can just leave a message.
Yuki sat there waiting for the new message indicator to start blinking. But it didn't. This, of course, sent Yuki fuming all the more.
What a jerk! If he really cared, he'd at least leave a message.
Yuki punched a few buttons and checked her voicemail just to be sure. She breathed a sigh of relief upon hearing that she had one new message. But then she was surprised when she heard from whom that message was from. Yuki closed her phone and took another bite of her apple. Mrs. Flack telling her not to worry repeatedly wasn't exactly convincing her that everything was going to be fine. But Mrs. Flack was the least of Yuki's problems. There was still the question of what to do about Tina. She pulled Mrs. Flack's purse out of her backpack and opened it, fishing around until she found the amethyst crystal. Of course, Yuki had chosen to overlook that it was in fact Crowley who had volunteered some knowledge that would remedy this particular situation. Yet, Yuki was sure that if she just looked hard enough, she would find the answers herself. She put the black silk cord around her neck. If anybody needed to focus their energy right now, it was her. One of the doctor's spare laptops was sitting on the counter next to her. Yuki pulled it over, opened it, and began to pore over the seemingly endless websites pertaining to ghosts. A few apples and several dead-end searches later, Yuki snickered to herself, although there was an abundance of information about ghosts on the internet. Mostly, it was of the sensational variety, overblown stories and rather shaky first-hand accounts of various hauntings. There was certainly nothing mentioning eradicating spirits with silver pistols and salty bullets. Undaunted, Yuki continued her search, deciding to try to find something specific to ghost summoning. And this is where things took a comic turn. After gleaning such helpful hints as
light a candle, breathe deeply, think calm thoughts, call the deceased's name?
That seemed to be the extent of it. There were no arcane spells or ancient rituals, mostly just a lot of deep breathing and name-calling. Yuki sighed as she took another apple. She tucked her phone in her pocket, moved off of the bar stool, and crossed the room, stepping carefully through the immaculately placed modern furniture like she was in a museum. Everything was so new and looked too perfect to touch. It was like a showroom. When Yuki reached the enormous bay window, the brass spiral staircase caught her eye. She reached over and gave it a rattle, remembering that the doctor had said it was broken. It seemed strong enough. Yuki wondered if, in fact, it had ever been repaired. She looked up to the walkway inside the turret overhead. The same four little windows, except it looked like you could actually see through these. Taking slow, careful steps, Yuki climbed up and around until she reached the top. She circled the walkway until she was looking out over the roof garden sitting in the moonlight. The weather-beaten pagoda and the cluster of gnarled dead cherry trees seemed a little more ominous at night. Yuki could make out a single raven sitting on one of the twisted branches, sawing back and forth as it cleaned its beak on its perch. Across the small courtyard, standing in the shadows, sat the entrance to the garden, another pair of double doors, and the only way Yuki would be able to get to them would be to cross to the other side of the house. It was time to have another crack at the north wing. And then Yuki's phone rang. She fished it out of her jeans pocket and saw that Crowley was calling again. Yuki rolled her eyes and sighed. Even though perhaps now she was a tad less annoyed with Crowley, she still pressed ignore and put her phone back in her pocket. There was a governess coming in the morning. There was no time to waste. After agonizing several minutes over where the keys to the north wing had escaped to, it was only after several frantic trips back and forth from her room to the kitchen that Yuki finally saw the key ring hanging from the lock in the double doors, just sitting there like it was waiting for her. As Yuki went to turn the key, she hesitated. There was a faint shimmer in the air. The woozy feeling returned suddenly, as well as an odd pressure that made her ears pop. The lights flickered and Yuki's vision began to blur. The freshly painted pale walls seemed to ripple and vibrate, revealing a swirling pattern of crimson. Large gilt-framed mirrors materialized out of thin air, hanging from walls now covered in blood-red flocked wallpaper. Every archway was now draped in rich black velvet. The double doors remained the same, perhaps a little more polished, but still quite closed. And while Yuki's vision cleared, revealing her new surroundings, she could hear sounds coming from somewhere beyond the double doors, voices that were getting louder and closer. Yuki leapt back as the double doors suddenly flew open. A man with round spectacles and a wild mop of sandy blonde hair burst out into the hall, carrying armfuls of notebooks. Yuki did a double take, thinking that Detective Golden had shown up again, but then she realized it was just a strong family resemblance. This was the quirky man she had seen before at the gala, the man who had built the tea maker. It was Vernal Golden, Crowley's great-great-grandfather. Vernal was followed by a wheezing and sputtering Milford Coyle. Yuki suddenly got the impression that some time must have passed since her previous visit to the past. While Vernal pretty much looked the same, Milford Coyle was positively elderly. His hair had gone thin and white, and his middle had expanded accordingly. Yuki watched Vernal turn and hand Coyle a new leather-bound book. She recognized the tea maker manual immediately.
"Here, this is what I was contracted to construct, and I've done that. But the rest of these designs are mine, and they're not for sale at any price."
"Oh, come on now, Vernal. Don't go flying off at the handle. Let's talk about this. You've got ideas for 100 fortunes there."
Golden wasn't hearing any of it. He shook his head as if he was trying to shake Milford's words out of his ears. He began to cross the hall, heading towards the door, when he stopped and suddenly stared at Yuki.
"And you, you're an evil woman. You and your society with their insatiable colt's tooth. You all sicken me."
Yuki suddenly realized that Vernal Golden wasn't speaking to her, but rather to Lady Iwanaga, who had crept up silently from behind.
"Why, Vernal? I am sure I do not know to what you are referring."
"Oh, don't make me laugh. Have you noticed that anyone who crosses you somehow meets with an unfortunate circumstance? Judge Greaves choking to death at his own table? The Dashwoods attacked by a swarm of crows on their doorstep? Santorini trapped in his studio as it mysteriously burnt to the ground? And then poor old Whitforce. He wasn't some dash-fire genius, but he surely didn't deserve what he got. Running blindly into the street, and then that trolley just running him down, catching him up in the wheels, and then dragging him until he was a red smear down Market Street. You said great things would happen in the new century. Well, here we are, Mrs. Coyle. 1906 has arrived, and I still haven't seen anything great from you. Just more blood on your hands. I feel sorry for you when all your plots and schemes finally catch up with you. Here, you can have this back as well."
Yuki stood frozen. She watched Vernal Golden reach into his pocket and remove a silver flask. He tossed it over, and without another word, stomped out and slammed the door behind him. Milford Coyle stood across the hall, his silver sideburns twitching with rage. He slammed the teamaker manual down on a side table, turned in a huff, and disappeared through the double doors. Lady Iwanaga glared, haughty and disdainful at the sight of Coyle departing, as the scarlet-flocked wallpaper faded back to a tasteful off-white. The ostentatious decor of gilt-framed mirrors and tasseled lampshades began to dissolve away and revert back to its modernized state. When her surroundings had settled, Yuki saw that the teamaker manual was still sitting where Coyle had left it, which was strange because she distinctly remembered leaving it with her backpack in the kitchen. The double doors were still open wide, a gaping maw that emanated a stale smell in perfect silence. Yuki reached along the wall again and found the light switch easily, and as before, only a few meager bulbs in the overhead chandelier came to life. The hallway was now partially blocked by the mounds of newspaper that had collapsed on each other after Yuki's previous trip down this particular corridor. She managed to climb over the heaps of paper and slowly made her way along, passing a few dingy rooms that were crammed full of nothing but piles of newspapers and magazines stacked nearly to the ceiling. The hallway ended, and Yuki walked into a large room. This was as far as she had made it last time. Row after row of porcelain urns still sat on the shelves in the tall alcove. Yuki did notice a few things that she had missed before, namely the enormous circular snake tiled on the floor, and the backpack wadded on the shelf where Tina's urn had previously been sitting. A piece of broken porcelain crunched under Yuki's shoe as she reached up to retrieve the backpack. She blew the dust and cobwebs off and examined it. The backpack was covered in safety pins and punk rock patches, a grinning skull, an eight ball, an anarchy symbol. Large, carefully detailed flaming letters in silver pen spelt out Tina on the flap. Yuki looked inside and found a rolled-up magazine of hairstyles from 1985, as well as some tangled headphones and an archaic Walkman that seemed really big and clunky. Yuki pushed the eject button and read the title on the cassette inside.
Teenage Knife Fight?
Yuki snapped the Walkman shut and pushed play, but nothing happened. She shook it a couple times, but still nothing. She guessed the batteries must have died ages ago. She scanned the shelves and noted that there were little bundles tucked in with the rest of the urns as well, like each one had its own little clutch of mementos to keep it company. She turned and scanned the circular pattern on the floor. The giant mosaic of the Ouroboros was meticulous in its detail. The tiny black glass tiles gleamed like scales through the layers of dust on the floor. There were five white low-burnt candles arranged evenly along the circle, forming a star. The chill Yuki had been waiting for finally ran down her spine.
Okay, what was Grandma doing in here?
She looked down at the backpack and remembered her internet research. She took a deep breath and tried to calm herself.
Hello, Tina? Tina Bleiberman? Are you here, or there, or whatever? Oh.
Yuki had no idea what she was doing. The air remained thick and heavy with a silence that seemed almost deliberate. Wherever Tina was, it looked like it was going to take a bit more than just calling out her name to get results. Yuki left the backpack and continued her search. The room had two other doorways which stood open. She peeked in through the smaller of these and found a library with rows of moldering books and several armchairs covered in cobwebs and dingy dust cloths. Another trolley sat there, the perfect twin of the one downstairs, except here, instead of a samovar and teacups, there were several dusty bottles of lethal-looking liqueurs. The larger doorway led to a succession of long galleries. The first contained traditional Japanese objects. Several antique kimonos were slowly disintegrating off of their display stands. The walls were crowded with a variety of illustrated scrolls and screens. Numerous wooden oni masks glared down wild-eyed at Yuki, their carved mouths wide with malevolent smiles. The next gallery was full of photography, portraits as well as group shots from a variety of eras, tintypes from the 1800s up to glamorous party shots from the 1920s and 30s. Some familiar faces seemed to repeat in several, including Derwinter and a few other members from the Ouroboros Society. There was one face in particular that popped up again and again. A young woman who always seemed to be standing next to Derwinter and Iwanaga. A young woman who looked strikingly like the Doctor. The gallery of photography opened to another large room that looked like it had been a music hall. A grand staircase across the room led up to another pair of heavy wooden doors decorated with golden cherry trees. As soon as she saw them, Yuki knew instinctively that the roof garden must lay beyond. Several couches and divans had been arranged around the edge of the room, all facing towards the center where there was a raised platform like a small stage. As Yuki moved closer, suddenly she saw that she was not alone. It appeared that someone was seated on the platform. Yuki wasn't sure what she was looking at. The curious figure was difficult to see in the murky shadows.
Hello?
The figure remained silent. Yuki bit her lip and moved a little closer. As she got nearer, details came into focus. Beneath a fine veil of cobwebs, a female figure was seated behind an ancient Japanese koto. She wore an elaborately traditional costume, a kimono covered in elegant gold and indigo embroidery, and a geisha hairdo decorated with several dangling ornaments. The figure was about Yuki's size and was eerily lifelike, the beautiful face frozen like a mask, looking out with a glassy stare of blackest obsidian. Yuki brushed aside the cobwebs and lightly ran a finger down the figure's cheek. It felt cold, like stone.
Oh, it's just a statue. That's weird.
Yuki circled the lady koto player. She noticed a flash of brass on the platform behind the figure. There was an old turnkey and a switch next to a small tarnished plaque that read, Lady Iwanaga by Santorini and Golden, 1895. It seemed that Vernal Golden's work extended well beyond the utilitarian. Unable to resist, Yuki wound the key a few times and pressed the switch. The figure started ticking like a clock, with the sounds of little gears suddenly sputtering to life. The arms raised, and finely jointed hands with articulated fingers emerged from the kimono sleeves. Long golden fingernails, curved and sharpened to a point, flashed in the faint light. The figure's posture changed and bowed over the koto, and those ghostly white fingers descended upon the strings. The effect was truly unsettling, the way the shoulders shifted and the head turned slightly to the side. Such subtle little movements, so lifelike. The music filled the large room with a strange staccato melody that sent a shiver through Yuki, like winding a little turnkey had started the heart of the house again, and the music was its first gasping breath. As the music washed over her, Yuki wasn't surprised at the return of the now familiar woozy feeling and blurry vision. The air began to shimmer as the figure of Lady Iwanaga continued to play. A heartbeat later, Yuki's vision cleared, and she saw that the dust and cobwebs had vanished off of the furniture. The room was like new again, yet oddly bathed in a flickering red light. The wooden doors now stood open, their golden cherry blossoms shimmering, reflecting a nighttime sky that was choked in drifting clouds of glowing smoke. They seemed to smolder with a fiery light from the city below. The sound of purposeful footsteps approached. Milford Coyle had returned. He looked frantic, dressed in his shirt sleeves, silver sideburns twitching and covered in soot. He darted up the stairs towards the roof garden without so much as a glance at Yuki.
Would you kindly shut off that confounded fiddle player before I take a hammer to it?
Yuki spun around to see that Lady Iwanaga had also appeared, standing next to her musical doppelganger. She was dressed in flowing robes of indigo-colored silk that billowed in the warm draft that blew through the room. Her black hair fell loosely down to the floor, pulled back off of her face with a black bone comb decorated with raven feathers. The effect of them side by side was unhinging. The koto player's head moved slightly to the side while she played on, mimicking Iwanaga's attitude perfectly. They both seemed to regard Coyle with simultaneous contempt. Yuki turned and followed Coyle up into the roof garden. She stood momentarily stunned from the blast of heat. The roof garden which greeted her was completely different from what she had seen from the tower windows. Now, the garden was in full bloom, like a perfect Zen oasis, immune to all the chaos which blazed away in the city below. The pagoda was freshly painted in its coat of shiny red lacquer. A small grove of perfectly manicured cherry trees stood in the center, their branches heavy with the blossoms that were gently being swept away on the hot wind and swallowed up by the clouds of ash and smoke. Coyle had climbed up to the widow's walk that ran along the edge of the roofline. His silver sideburn seemed to ignite in the orange fiery glow as he stared out over the city. Yuki followed, and the view that she found there took her breath away. San Francisco was on fire. There were no bridges and no skyscrapers, only miles of incinerated low-slung buildings and scorched rubble. A few iron skeletons of tall buildings stood resolutely along Market Street, silhouetted against the flames which seemed to be gorging themselves with no end in sight. A sudden blast in the distance sent several intact buildings crumbling to the ground. The fire brigades were now dynamiting blocks at a time, trying to keep the flames from spreading, but the sparks from their firewalls only seemed to spread the inferno.
Ah, no! What have they done? The idiots are setting new fires!
Yuki walked closer to the edge and peered over. Now there was no neighborhood, just a smoldering hillside that ran down to the wall of flame that had engulfed Chinatown and was working its way toward North Beach. The other grand houses of Knob Hill that had once stood to the south had been destroyed, reduced to eerie blackened chimney stacks and charred fragments crinkled like burnt matchsticks. In fact, Yuki had to wonder why Coyle was complaining, because you could pretty much say that Coyle House was the one thing that hadn't burned to the ground on Knob Hill. It was as if the flames thought it would be rude to use Mrs. Coyle's house for kindling.
Such a calamity.
Yuki saw that Iwanaga was now standing under the cherry trees. She was admiring a raven which was sitting on one of the branches. Milford Coyle turned to look at her with disdain.
What's that now? You've got something to say?
The raven cawed, and Iwanaga tilted her head towards Coyle.
A pity that all the birds have been scared away. We'll just have to hope that they can find their way home.
Find their way home? Confound it, woman! Are you aware that half of the city is on fire? I think there's more to worry about than just your blasted birds.
Milford Coyle, why do you complain? Can you not see? This disaster has not touched us. You should be grateful.
Milford's eyes were wide and lit with the flames that blazed in the distance.
Grateful? Oh, really? Well, aren't you hilarious? Look at you, all trussed up like some evil hoodoo priestess. You and your pack of soft heads. You should be out on them burning streets, my dear. Especially now. You know what they used to do to your sort, don't you?
Indeed. There are still far too many narrow minds in this century for my liking. So blind to the many opportunities all around them.
Coyle's eyes narrowed.
Oh, yes. And what more do you want, madam? I think I've been more than accommodating. You've already feathered your nest rather nicely, I'd say.
Feathered? Yes, I suppose I have.
The raven sitting in the cherry tree squawked while Iwanaga removed the black comb from her hair. Once set free, it seemed to have a life of its own. The black serpentine tresses lifted and writhed on the warm draft coiling around her. Iwanaga ran the raven feathers over her lips and smiled. Milford Coyle looked less than impressed.
Oh, what's this? You don't scare me with your hoodoo.
Iwanaga remained silent and opaque, lightly running the feathered comb along her cheek. Yuki noticed another raven had appeared and was now sitting with its fellow. And then a moment later, there were more fluttering wings descending, until eventually the branches were full of black gleaming eyes and formidable beaks and talons. Iwanaga calmly addressed her husband.
Dear Milford, I fear our time is finally at an end.
Now just hold on a minute. Don't go doing anything hasty. You want this house? Fine, keep it. I can build 100 more, but you'll never be happy in it. Live forever? Ha! You don't live at all. You're stuck here, cooped up in your castle. I don't need to bother cursing you. You've already cursed yourself.
Yes, that may be so. Goodbye, Milford.
A chorus of squawking suddenly rose from the trees. The black swarm of iridescent wings shot towards Coyle and brought him to his knees. He cried out desperately while covering his face in a vain attempt to protect himself. Razor-sharp beaks and talons began to rip at his flesh. A guttural scream came from Coyle while the ravens pecked and tore at his fingers. Then he made the fatal mistake of trying to swat the birds away. Coyle's face was immediately obscured by a blur of black. He screamed again, and Yuki shuddered at the sight of him. Drenched in blood, any recognizable features had been torn away, revealing gleaming white bone. His breath heaved in bloody gasps as he staggered back. In one final gurgle of agony, Milford Coyle toppled over backwards off of the roof, disappearing into the darkness that smoldered below. The ravens hovered over Coyle House, flying in ever-widening circles before eventually being swallowed up by the night.
Well, I thought he'd never leave.
Still quailing from the horror of Coyle's gruesome death, another prickle of shock bolted through Yuki at the sight of Dervinter, who had suddenly emerged and joined Iwanaga under the cherry trees. Their forms began to shimmer as they embraced. Suddenly the fiery scene had been quenched. The nighttime skyline had cooled to an inky blue. The little office window lights winked at Yuki again from the cluster of skyscrapers. And while the city was restored and appeared new again, The roof garden was gnarled and forgotten once more. The lush cherry trees where Iwanaga and Devinter had been standing were now empty, twisted, and dead. Yuki took a deep breath and fished her phone out of her jeans pocket.
Okay, maybe now is a good time to call Crowley.
She dialed his number and waited, a sinking feeling getting deeper with each passing ring that he didn't answer. As the message for his voicemail began, Yuki was perplexed. Why wasn't Crowley answering his phone? Meanwhile, across town in the Haight-Ashbury, the lights were on inside Morty Golden's garage. Crowley was keeping himself busy while he nervously waited for his dad's return. He had tried to call Yuki a couple of times to make sure she was okay, but she hadn't answered her phone, which wasn't exactly comforting.
What if something had gone wrong?
The more time he had to think about his decision to get his dad involved with the whole Curse Castle business, the more it looked like his mom was right about it being a bad idea. He hated when that happened. So, to get his mind off things, Crowley had taken to a bit of exploring of his own, namely poking around downstairs in the garage, which contained a virtual archive of Golden family history. Something Yuki had mentioned during their brief chat earlier had gotten him to thinking.
A spectral Tina Bleiberman had been shot with a big silver pistol.
Crowley remembered something about that in one of his great-great-grandfather's journals. Vernal Golden had been the very definition of the eccentric inventor. Sadly, his designs had been dismissed as fancy at the time, and the rest of his grand designs faded into obscurity. He did, however, meticulously record all of his endeavors in a series of books that he had bound himself, and which now occupied an entire bookcase in Morty Golden's garage. Crowley shined his flashlight over the spines of the books. The good news was that there was now enough room to maneuver around the garage, since his dad's enormous Cadillac, the Golden Juggernaut, wasn't parked in it. The bad news was that there were hundreds of journals to pore through. Luckily, Crowley's dad was a stickler for organization, and had everything neatly alphabetized, so Crowley didn't have to look very long before he reached the C's and saw a large volume with Coil House printed on the spine. Crowley opened the book and began to flip through its detailed pages. It must have been one of Vernal's first accounts, dating all the way back to 1885. Custom designs for intricate plumbing and electrical systems that certainly had to have been groundbreaking for the time. Crowley read over a number of entries and his eyes popped. Apparently, Vernal Golden had collaborated with several different people while he was working on Coil House. One name in particular practically burned off of the page.
Desmond Derventer?
There was a sudden noise overhead. Crowley heard the sound of the front door closing and footsteps crossing the floor.
Finally! About time he got home!
Crowley set Vernal Golden's journal down and headed up the stairs. He was anxious to talk to his dad and hear about how everything had gone down at the Curse Castle. Crowley made his way to the kitchen, but didn't see any sign of his dad anywhere. However, there was an oddly noxious perfume drifting in from somewhere. It made Crowley's eyes sting a little. Suddenly, he was aware of a figure standing in the kitchen doorway that definitely wasn't his father.
Ah, there you are. Good evening, darling. You're Crowley, yes? Yuki's little friend?
Crowley nodded uncertainly at the strange red-headed woman in dark sunglasses. He noticed his father's house keys dangling from her long purple fingernails.
Excellent. I think we need to have a little chat.
The woman approached while lowering her sunglasses. Her golden eyes blazed with yellow fire. Crowley's stare widened and sort of glazed over as he slouched slightly with a dull grin.
Just a little tete-a-tete about what you must do when your father returns.
And so, Chapter 11 comes to a close. I'd like to thank guest voices on this episode: Mike Bennett as Milford Coyle, Tawny Tackett as Lady Iwanaga, Jennifer Viale as Mrs. Flack, and Leanne Parker as Yuki. Music on the program provided by freesound.org and at comptech.com. For more info, please check out the Latchkey Tales fan page on Facebook. Please stay tuned for Chapter 12. And until then, this is MJ Hahn saying goodbye for now, and thanks for listening.
I know what you're up to, and don't think for a minute that I'm going to let you go get...